software.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The literature of Russia has a deep and a heavy voice, from Pushkin through Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and Solzhenitsyn. Using such profound prose and ideas, the writers called for the world to take notice, and the world did take notice. Even through the decades after the revolution, it was the writers who condemned the failings of communism, and the writers who suffered for that. Well, then came perestroika, and then the fall of communism. The Moscow writer Viktor Yerofeyev says that at the end of the 80s, quote, Soviet literature broke off as if in mid-sentence. There was total confusion in the household of Russian letters. Writers were left without a literature. Well, that may be changing now. Today, in the next installment of our series, New Writers, New Realities, we look at the state of Russian fiction today with a particular focus on the work of one man, Vladimir Sorokin. He is little known in this country because his work is so hard to translate. But in Russia, events of the last couple of years have vaulted him to the forefront of Russian letters. Connection listeners, what role does the writer play in rebuilding the soul of a nation? Can contemporary novelists have power and influence in the new Russia? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me in the studio today are Svetlana Boyum, she's professor of literature at Harvard University, and Gary Steingart, he's the author of a new piece on contemporary Russian fiction, which includes Vladimir Sorokin. It's going to be published very soon in The New Yorker. Watch for that. You'll probably recognize Gary's name. He's the author of the novel, The Russian Debutante Handbook. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Gary, you were with Vladimir Sorokin just this summer, I gather. Tell me a little bit about this man. Is he the remarkable new man of Russian letters?
Well, it's hard to say, but he's certainly the man of the moment. If you opened up, at least in mid-August or early August when I was in Moscow, if you opened up a newspaper or a journal, his name would be featured at some point because he was involved in a very high-profile lawsuit by pro-Kremlin group that has accused him of writing pornography. And if you've read some of his work, which involves most notoriously his second-to-last novel called Golubaya Sala, which means blue lard, you will see certainly quite a bit of pornography. Most famously, a scene between Khrushchev and Stalin, a lovemaking scene between the two, which is quite unexpected for anyone who certainly grew up in the former Soviet Union.
Golubaya Sala translates literally to blue lard, but there's a play in the words there. Golubaya carries something else with it.
That's
from Russian.
Right. Golubaya may also denote homosexual. So we're talking about gay lard in some ways as well, as the scene with Khrushchev and Stalin amply illustrates.
All right. Maybe we should just get a sense of how this man writes. And to do this, what I'm going to do, Svetlana, is ask you to perhaps just read the opening paragraph from Golubaya Sala. And we'll listen to you read for a bit and then bring Gary in to tell us what we're hearing, because you're going to read in Russian.
Okay, with pleasure. It's a part of a love letter, gay love letter. 2 января. Привет, мой птит. Тяжелый мальчик мой, нежная сволочь, божественный мерзкий топ-директ. Вспоминать тебя, адское дело, рип-слауав. Это тяжело в прямом смысле слова и опасно для снов. Для
And Gary, what are we hearing now, as Svetlana reads?
What we're hearing is, as Svetlana said, a gay love letter. But what's interesting about it is that it's written some 100 years into the future, when Russia has become sort of a subset of China. And the author of the letter is writing from deep within Siberia, from deep within a secret vault within Siberia, where a top-secret project is taking place. Clones of famous Russian authors, such as Nabokov and Tolstoy, are being harvested for a special protoplasm called blue lard, which has special properties that we later find out about. What is most interesting about this text is that Sorokin, while of course Svetlana read in Russian, Sorokin intermixes a lot of Chinese words and specially designed Chinese mixture of Chinese and Russian words throughout the text, not to mention occasional lapses into English, German, and French and other languages.
Svetlana, is it his use of all the toying around with different languages and words that makes it hard for the work to be translated from Russian into English.
Yes, because it's not really written in Russian. It's written in the Eurasian American. For instance, the favorite curse word is the word rips. And at the end of the book, there is a little dictionary, and it explained that the word rips became common in the oral speech of Eurasians after the Oklahoma nuclear catastrophe of 2028 and comes from the name of the American surgeon, Jonathan Rips, who was a journalist who documented for 25 days the disappearance and burning of his body.
But this book was number two in Russia. Yes, that's right. This one was number two, and he's got a brand new one out called Ice, which has been was shortlisted for the Booker. Is it that it physically cannot be translated?
In a sense, you'd be double translating. You're translating from the Sorokin into the Russian and then into the English. And if you lose in the translation, if things get lost in the translation from one language to another, try from one language to a second language to a third language, I think you'd be left with some very problematic results, although I welcome anyone to try.
Now, you've both read the book in Russian.
Yes.
Did you like it?
Well, personally, I loved it. And I was stuck in Azerbaijan for a while, traveling on this rickety bus, and I read it in one sitting. And it was just, and what I, you know, humorous fiction is my favorite. And what a lot of people don't comment about, but the one thing that really drew me to it is that this is really funny stuff. You know, his play on language, his alliterations, and his parodies of Nabokov and Tolstoy. I mean, these are really very funny.
I would say I liked it. I love his other earlier books. This book I liked because at a certain point it began to seem to me that he is using himself as a style and he's reproducing his style over and over again. And I'm noticing that there is a certain crisis of language now in Russia. Many writers are inventing new languages, like Pelevin writes and kind of Russia-American. Tatiana Tolstoya wrote a dystopian novel trying to kind of invent the neo-Slavic bestial Eurasian.
Now,
language.
You've just named two of the other young new writers who are gathering attention.
New, but.
but Pelevin and Tolstoya is her name. They're also popular in Russia at this moment with the literature set, right? Not the pulp romance. But you began, Gary, by saying that he attracted a lot of attention when this pro-Putin group marching together or walking together, however you translate their name, marching, I suppose,
moving together
began to criticize him for publishing pornography.
Yeah.
And so he became a writer who was being targeted, if only indirectly, by the administration.
Right. Even before that, though, he's been around for a long time, by the way, but he made a little bit of a headway with young readers when he appeared, this is very postmodern, when he appeared on a Russian show, which is sort of like a reality-based show. It was called «За стеклом», «Behind the Glass», which is sort of like, I guess, the real world in America. You know this show where the youngsters sit around and talk about their problems. So he was a guest on this show because one of the youngsters had read his novel. So that was his entree into the world of young people. But then he was targeted by this group called Moving Together, which it's a very murky whether it's connected to the Putin administration. But what they do is they wear these, it's about 40,000 members, maybe less. It's hard to pinpoint. But they wear these T-shirts with Putin's likeness on them. In fact, I'm wearing now a T-shirt which has a sort of a response to it, which is Putin with an M&M-style halo on top. This is, I bought it at a nightclub.
We'll get a photograph of your T-shirt. We'll put it on our website for people to see it.
Wonderful.
It's great.
And so they started all these different actions in support of Putin. And some of them were very weird, like they were trying to ban Portuguese-style corridas in the middle of Moscow. I don't know where this came from, but they keep latching onto an idea and they couldn't find one. And finally they found one. They said, we're going to decry the state of modern Russian literature. We want more patriotic themes in our literature. We don't want scatology, this kind of scatological approach that Sorokin does, and we don't want Pelevin. So they organized these so-called book swaps, where you would bring a book by Sorokin or Pelevin, or strangely enough, by Karl Marx, and you would exchange it for a traditional Soviet book, you know, a book...
report on the Agriculture Committee
patriotic war novels, like by Vasiliev, or Platon, you could be exchanged for Pushkin
So this group is a sort of post-Soviet pioneer group?
Right. Mm-hmm. They're likened to the Komsomol, which was the Soviet Youth League. And this is exactly what they remind you of, because they have a lot of fervor, but they're also completely misguided, and they're also completely controlled by somebody. And the question is, who? I talked to a lot of Moscow journalists who didn't know, you know, what exactly are the ties to Putin? And a lot of them thought that perhaps that Putin disapproved of this lawsuit against Sorokin because, while Putin certainly hates it when the media, he clamps down the media when they criticize his ill-begotten war in Chechnya, on the other hand, what do they care, what does Putin care if some guy writes about Khrushchev boinking Stalin? I
mean, but if Putin's so-called people are criticizing the writer Sorokin, it's got to be good for the writer Sorokin, doesn't it, Svetlana?
Yes, it's a kind of double bind. I want to comment a little bit on the action that this Moving Forward organized. They actually created a makeshift toilet in front of Bolshoi Theater, where they were supposedly disinfecting the works of Sorokin. If you think of it, it's a sort of performance art in its own right, you know. But it, of course, has grim references in Russian culture and in German culture, the whole fight against degenerate art. And the most dangerous part of it is that they opened criminal case. And I believe that it's the moment that the law gets involved and the criminal case is opened against Sorokin, this is where the problem starts.
And we should be, I suppose, quite clear about this. This is not just some group of citizens taking a civil case against Sorokin. This is something that comes from the judiciary, which takes its orders from the administration, right?
That's right. There is no real separation between the prosecutor's office and the administration. So because lately it seems that the government, that the prosecutors are not very keen on persecuting this case, on moving this case forward in a very big way. So this is obviously a sign to most people that the administration wants to back off and is not very interested in this.
If I can jump in on this, it always seemed to me that there is a game of good cop, bad cop going on with Putin government. It's as if they need somebody to express more radical views so then they can appear more Western and more pro-Western and not persecuting writers. And I'll mention two things. I mean, Putin himself is known to use curse words, particularly vis-a-vis the Chechens, whom he said he'll be strangling in the closet. And then he was,
I think he said he'd be cutting off their male appendages.
That's the second quote. Years ago, he mentioned about strangling them in the closet, machit v klozete, and now it's about circumcision, and it's used as an insult. So the president is known for harsh language himself. But the really serious issue is that what's going on now in Russia is an attempt to create new national culture with restoration of the hymn and with other things that are going on, an attempt to restore Dzerzhinsky statue that we discussed here in The Connection, and so on and so forth. So generally, Putin's program goes together with marching together. It's just perhaps they became a little bit too radicalized, and now they're hurting the Western image of the Russian president.
Gary, when you talk to Sorokin, does he say, I should say that we asked him to join us on the program, even in a translated interview, and he said, I'm only going to appear on public radio in the United States when somebody translates my books into English. I can see that there's a little bit of a cash register in his head, but does he see himself as part of a movement, a literary movement that works against the administration?
No, I don't think he's. I don't think he's very politicized at all in that sense. I mean, obviously, he wants. He obviously can't be happy with what is happening in a place like Chechnya. But on the other hand, I don't think him is a very politicized writer at all. You know, he's somebody who's much more obsessed with Russian literature. All the parodies that he does, which are. Striking and note perfect in some ways, and also very almost callous in some ways. All of this points to a mind which is obsessed with Russian literature above everything.
Connection listeners, we're talking about Vladimir Sorokin, highly regarded young writer, not so young, but new writer in Russia today, and what his work tells us about the new literature coming from Russia. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we invite you to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a continuing program in our series looking at new writers, new realities, literature as it changes around the world. With me in the studio, I have Gary Steingart, author of a piece about the writer we're discussing, Vladimir Sorokin, which is coming out shortly in The New Yorker. He published his first novel this year. It's called The Russian Debutant Handbook. Svetlana Boym's also with me. She's a professor of literature at Harvard University, and she has a novel called Ninochka. It's coming out this spring. Did I pronounce it right?
Yes.
Now, Gary, your book has gathered terrific reviews and all kinds of attention in the United States as a book about someone who was born in Russia and returns and gets a little bit fed up with the whole immigrant experience. What is it about the way that Russian literature is either consumed or not consumed in this country that we're talking about Sorokin, who's particularly well known in Russia and so little known in America?
It's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of I think for Sorokin accesses so many points of reference in terms of the way that Russian language is structured, but also in terms of certain facts that only a former Soviet citizen would know, that I think if you put it all together and intermix it with Chinese, French, English, what have you, it almost ends up to an American reader looking like a text about a computer language, you know, Fortran or COBOL or one of those languages.
Almost an inside joke?
It's almost an inside joke, but the inside joke is such, it's so well crafted and the payoff is so funny that it makes it worthwhile. But I think for a lot of people it would be very difficult to penetrate the many, many layers that Sorokin puts in. And for instance, Pelevin has met some success in America, particularly his first book or his first novel to be translated, I believe, Omon Ra, which is about the Soviet space program. And I think what makes that so much more accessible is it is written about strictly about a space program which Americans can also understand. And it's, you know, it has a lot of allegory and things like that, which also make it penetrable to the American reader. Then he wrote another book, which I liked very much in the Russian original, called The Generation P, which was translated here as Homo Sapiens. I tried reading it, and I realized that this book, like Sorokin's to some extent, also has a lot of layers behind it, a lot of references, a lot of in-jokes. And I realized that the translation, as well as it was done, and it was a pretty good translation, I think, it was pretty much impossible to decipher completely, to get everything, to get every level and to derive satisfaction from every level.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to Jim, who's joining us from Brookline. Hi, Jim.
Hello, yes.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. Hello, Svetlana. This is Jim Cates calling.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Press. And we publish some Russian literature. I'm a little bit disturbed with the political lens that we always tend to view Russian literature through. It seems like a remnant of the Cold War, that we can talk about other literatures in terms of the breadth of the writers, but we seem to focus on what is actually a very vital literature in contemporary poetry and prose only when we look at it through a narrow political lens, when there's a lot of work out there, not just Pelevin, not just Sorokin, who are writers that I like. And I'd like to, I guess, some sort of comment on our tendency to look at Russian literature only when there's a political issue.
Isn't it in part, Jim, I'm going to let Svetlana answer the question in a minute, but just to sort of try and understand it, isn't it in part because when we're reading writing from another country, we often use that writing to try and understand the other country, and in understanding, we're not looking at just the literature, but we're looking at the society and the politics and the way that the writer fits into that.
But if there is so much more, I mean, we tend to look only at Russian things only through looking at the politics, not at the experimentation of
right.
language, not at the breadth of poetry. And we also tend to focus on a single writer and to take that writer as emblematic when we're thereby distorting a very broad culture.
Well, I completely agree with you. I do believe that literature should not be read ethnographically. Literature should be read as literature. Unfortunately, to penetrate American media and American market, you need some kind of strategy of success, and often it's a scandal. I mean, one could be reminded of Nabokov, who was a Russian-American writer for about 20 years and virtually not very well known until Lolita came around. So I almost feel that Sorokin is kind of imitating the same strategy of success, and is actually getting access to much broader audience through the scandal. But I actually agree with Jim. What's interesting about Sorokin is that he is an interesting writer. I would actually challenge people to translate him, and then we could talk whether Americans like him or not. There is often kind of a premature murder of a foreign writer, you know, that the agents and all the kind of mediators decide that he would be inaccessible. I think it could be read as a kind of ludic, funny, carnivalesque, interesting text. But if I may jump in and comment a little bit on the political in the case of Sorokin, which is not so simple. Sorokin comes from the whole rich kind of underground culture of 1970s, 1980s, the movement that was also known as Moscow Conceptualism. And one might know such artists as Komaran Melamed and Kabakov, who live now in the United States, poets like Dmitry Prigov, Lev Rubinstein, who were part of this movement. And what I would be very brief, but what characterized it is, in a way, creating kind of a museum of Soviet culture, using languages as playful objects, using ideological symbols somewhat in a similar way that Andy Warhol used advertisement, you know, to play with them, to reflect on them, to create this new museum, to kind of recycle those ideological languages in this new museum of Soviet culture. And Vladimir Sorokin comes from this underground, unofficial tradition. And now he's kind of trying to enter mass culture, and that's what we're witnessing, how an experimental writer, something like Barthes or DeLille or Pynchon, is trying to become a mass writer.
Jim,
don't
quickly.
We see other writers doing the same thing also?
What?
In other words, other writers from that same era and from that same experimentation also entering in. I'm thinking of Sergei Gondlevsky to begin
mm-hmm.
with.
Sure, absolutely. I should name, you know, much more names like Gondlevsky, Rubinstein, Prigov, and many, many others, Timur Kibirov, and many others. Perhaps they are difficult to translate, but it doesn't mean they shouldn't be translated, to challenge the whole question of facility. And that literature should be transparent. Literature should be difficult and fun.
Gary Steingart, is there anything to the idea that it's easier for a writer to be published or to be noticed if he or she comes from the underground tradition in Russia?
Well, I think what's interesting about this case is the fact that it's not just us. It's not just people in America who react, you know, when we open up the Times and we see, oh, there's this gentleman named Sorokin who is being persecuted. But people in Russia took notice in a very big way. Sales of Golubaya Stal, of Blue Lard, jumped from 5,000 to 60,000, which is quite large in Russia, after the public flushing of his books in the outside the Bolshoi Theater. So there's a lot of attention to be gleaned from political acts, because I think in Russia there is still that kind of easy membrane between literature and politics that probably shouldn't exist. You know, fights broke out during the when the book exchange program, you know, when Sorokin's books were to be exchanged for good Soviet patriotic literature, there were fisticuffs. Now think of a country in the world where people will go to bat, you know, will pick up a stick and hit each other over the head with it over literature. I mean, it's both exciting and somewhat frightening. And certainly very, very unusual.
And Sorokin is saying that his novel is about the death of Russian literature, yet in a way it shows that Russian literature is still pretty much alive if people care so much about it.
Jim, thanks a lot for your call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Jan, who's joining us also from Boston. Hi, Jan.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine.
I just wanted to ask, I had emigrated from Russia myself about 13 years ago, and
how old were you when you left, Jan?
I was 11 years old.
Okay.
And I've been in this country for a while, and I've gone back a few times, but you know, only a couple of months at a time, so not to notice exactly the trends in culture. And my question is this, whether or not young people are still reading as much as they used to during Soviet times, whether the requirements in school are as heavy, heavily based on literature, and whether or not, you know, video games and TV have taken over as they have in this country.
Okay, yeah. Gary?
Video games and TV are very quickly taking over. I think the average Russian youngster now watches at least as much as the average American teen. On the other hand, this is all very anecdotal, but if you take a ride on the metro, you will see a lot of young people cracking open some very big books. Whether that's assigned in school, yes, a lot of it is. But I think Russia still is a much more literary society, but it's being very quickly and very heavily encroached by Western media. You know, MTV Russia. There's like several MTV channels in Russia, in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, and the video games are video internet cafes are everywhere. So it's going to change very quickly, and I wonder what the role of literature, as we can see from this incident, the role of literature is still very strong right now in 2002. What will be the case in 2022 is up for grabs, I think.
I notice among young people there is a revival, a new interest in literature. For instance, one of the most popular clubs in Moscow, Club IGI, is a bookstore club that's open till 4 o'clock in the morning. You can't imagine anything like that even in New York.
Are they reading Russian writers? Are they reading Russian translations of British books and American books as well?
Or European. I think they're reading all of the above.
Club IGI actually has a very big selection of the Ad Marginem, which is the publisher of Sorokin. They have a huge bunch of his books there, and I think they're pretty well read there, too.
There is this little piece of writing. I was thinking of it as Jim was talking earlier about how we don't necessarily, or how we want to put everything into a political box when we think about it in Russia, because the relationship of this country to the Soviet Union was such a political one. And this is given to me by Allison, who's helping produce this hour. This is from The Nose, Nikolai Gogol, 1830s. He begins his very last part of the short story by saying, "The world is full of absolute nonsense." And he ends it by saying, "Strangest of all, the most incomprehensible thing is that there are authors who can choose such subjects to write about." What he's writing about is how a man's nose falls off and reappears. "This, I confess, is completely inexplicable. It's like, no, I can't understand it at all. In the first place, there is absolutely no advantage in it for our mother country. Secondly, well, what advantage is there in it at all? I simply cannot understand what it is." And Sorokin, as we talk about him borrowing from his literary ancestors, does borrow from quite a strong tradition of the absurd. Okay. And the right to write whatever one wants to write about in Russia. That's the way that Gogol asserts that, 200 years ago.
Right. Well, the ending of this paragraph is that he says that, well, we can't really permit such works to be published. But then again, strange things do happen, something like that.
Oh, you're very, very good. This is the last two lines that I
read. Yes, I don't have his text in front of me. I know it by heart. But it really ends up with the affirmation of the absurdity. And perhaps absurdity has a very direct connection to Russian life. Perhaps that is a true realism, that the only way to write about the kind of life that is stranger than fiction in Russia is to write like that. And in fact, it's interesting, in one of the interviews, Sorokin quotes Churchill, who said that Russia is an enigma shrouded in mystery, and something like that. And he says that it is an enigma still shrouded in mystery, and all kinds of corpses are coming out from this shroud. So in a way, this is an indirect way, via absurdity, that his works do comment on the situation in Russia.
Very interesting. He goes at a lot of absurdities. I mean, Stalinism is sort of also at the center of this book, and it gets a nice thrashing. But one of the parts of this book, speaking about absurdities, is a kind of play which deals with ritualized murder by Jews. Anti-Semitism, of course, has always been an issue in Russia. Mm-hmm. And he has an entire play.
This is murder by, not murder of Jews?
Murder by Jews. Jews are planning to get blood from, I can't remember what the exact circumstances are. So it's blood murder. And, you can't think of a touchier subject. And even some lawmakers in the Russian parliament said, this book is sort of a manual for skinheads. But what he's doing very cleverly, I think, is parodying the way that anti-Semitism has flourished in Russia. And in a way, he's sort of deflating the myth, which is what good Russian writers, I think, do in some ways. And he's deflating the myth of the blood ritual. And I think so it's just yet another target, along with Stalinism, along with the Soviet state, that he very goes after in a very clear and brilliant manner, I think.
Because part of it is the shock value of literature, certainly in the 1990s, as writers cast about for what was going to attract the attention of readers. It was, in many ways, the ability to shock. And Sorokin's been marked as part of that, Svetlana, with his use of vomit and necrophilia and I mean, just about everything else that he's got in his bag of tricks.
Mm-hmm. If you think of the word obscene, what does it mean? On the one hand, it means vulgar. On the other hand, it means off the scene, or rather to be somewhat marginal. And I think for Sorokin, vulgarity and obscenity is not interesting per se. It's interesting to play that kind of cultural marginalia against dominant culture. And there is also the whole tradition of writers' trials in the Soviet context, particularly in the 60s, the trial of Sinyavsky Terts, who actually adopted, he's not Jewish, he adopted a Jewish pseudonym, and he was one of the, in his case, he was accused of anti-Semitism, while in fact he was doing precisely the opposite, criticizing official anti-Semitism. And he ended up in exile, then the trial of Brodsky, and it's interesting that the marching forward, that movement was saying that Sorokin is a marginal writer, and we would like to see him packing his bags, which is a direct reference to all those writers' trials that happened before.
Packing his bags means packing his bags for
and
the Gulag?
Leaving Russia, because, you know, writers' trials in the 30s culminated usually with the death of the writer, mm-hmm. literally. Writers' trials in the 60s culminated with writers' immigration. So Sorokin is another marginal figure who doesn't belong to our great Russian culture, and what will happen with him would be quite indicative.
What's funny, of course, is that by marginalizing or trying to marginalize him, they put him directly into the mainstream. Yeah, so they're not very well acquainted with modern PR methods.
Right. Oh, they may be. This is another interesting question. PR, magic word. In Russian, it's PR, which I didn't understand. It's public relation.
That's what they call it, PR.
PR, or people who are doing PR are called PR-shiki, which is a wonderful word.
And there's also черный PR, which is
black PR. That's the worst. But the problem with PR is that nobody knows who starts it. So the whole country is shrouded in rumors. So it's very difficult. I found it kind of almost upsetting that people couldn't unite and just say that there shouldn't be a criminal case against Sorokin, say intellectuals, because they were all suspecting that somebody is doing Sorokin's PR because what happened to him actually, you know, was very marketable. Actually, you know, the sales for his books went up.
Well, it's partly rooted, is it not, in the suspicion that nobody really knows who's putting the book in the bookstore, who's putting the song on the radio station, who's putting the story in the newspaper.
Well, speaking of, there was recently a song that made the best, the hit list called I Want a Man Like Putin. Where a girl sings about her boyfriend who he's lazy, he's drunk all the time, and she says, I want a man like Putin who can give me good ideas, who can lead me. I want a new boyfriend, a boyfriend like Putin. And the mystery was, you know, who put this song out? And for a long time, people thought maybe it was Moving Together, maybe it was the administration itself. It was kind of a catchy song, you know. And nobody figured it out. So it
was nobody knows to this
day. Nobody knows to this day.
1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, our conversation about new writers and new realities focusing on Russia this hour. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about some of the latest writing that's coming out of Russia and some of the writers who are getting attention, among them Vladimir Sorokin, whose latest book, Yod, Ice, was shortlisted for the Booker in Russia. His book, Goluboy Sala, Light Blue Lard or Light Blue Fat, was also well-received in Russia, but don't rush down to your local bookstore to try and get copies of either one of those because they have not yet been translated into English unless you choose to read them in Russia. Russian. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Boston, Massachusetts now. Anne's on the line. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine.
Terrific. Hi. I just want to let you know, I read Gary's book and really enjoyed it. And
this is the Russian Debutante Handbook by Gary Steingart.
That's
one of my
right.
guests. Yeah.
Yeah, and I read it because I recently lived in Lithuania for 2.5 years, and as we all know, which I didn't until I went there, but Lithuania was a former Soviet republic. So I got some exposure to Russia and the Soviet Union that I never would have gotten as an American because I didn't realize then all the propaganda that we got about Russia, Russian people, politics, and all that. One of the things that I found fascinating is the people that I lived with, the Lithuanians who were forced to learn Russian from the time they were small children, forced to do everything Russian or Soviet. I don't know, maybe there's a difference, but there was a love of the literature, a love of the language, and a love of the culture, which I found really fascinating because typically, I don't know what the situation is with oppressors, but I found it fascinating. And the thing that I found kind of disappointing in a way is because of, we don't have, as Americans, we don't have the same cultural references. My friends in Lithuania, they didn't have the same cultural references. So when I would try to talk about books or make references to things, we couldn't understand each other, even though we understood the words. So I'm curious about even translating these Russian novels that are coming out. I'm wondering.
But you didn't need a whole lot of exposure to the history of that place to get the jokes that are in Gary's book, right?
Well, I lived there, and I'll tell you, and I also traveled afterwards for 3 months. I traveled in other former Soviet countries, and had I just picked up that book, I would have missed several things. As if I had read it before I left and lived there, I would have missed it because there are just ways of being in a household, the way people do things,
right.
All that. You can't, you know, if you haven't been there and somebody tells you, you just don't get it. So for me, I found for myself, I mean, I'm sure I probably didn't get it all either, but just being exposed and living that situation. I lived in the community. I lived and worked in a community. I did not earn an American salary while
Gary,
I was there.
You were quite young when you left.
That's right. And you know, and when I wrote this book, I made sure to I mean, one of the things I needed was, because it was based primarily for an American audience, later it'll be translated
right.
into languages in Europe, but I wanted to make sure that people got as much as I could offer them in terms.
Mm-hmm.
So if I needed to, you know, delve into a little explanation here or there, I would do so. Of course, a lot is still probably indecipherable for certain readers, and that's one of the problems in being sort of bicultural and trying to communicate from one culture to another. I'll add another thing. You made an interesting point, I think, about how Russian literature, even though the Soviet Union and the Russian part of it was considered the oppressor of many of these many of these small republics, but the love of Russian literature still continues to an amazing extent. I was in Georgia last summer, Georgia in the former Soviet Union, Tbilisi, the capital, and Pushkin, of course, was there, and he took advantage of their wonderful sulfur baths, and there is still a wonderful statue of Pushkin in the middle of the city, and just as a little background, Georgia is currently in a very low-level crisis with Russia. There's even talk of war. There's a lot of disagreements between the two, and there's certainly no love lost between the Russian and Georgian people. But any educated or even uneducated person you will speak to will know at least a few verses of Pushkin by heart in Georgia, and
yeah.
people still congregate around the statue of Pushkin in Tbilisi.
And is that, Svetlana, because the Soviets had 70 years to teach people to embrace the literature, or that there is something which goes beyond the political oppression that sort of reaches through, whether or not it's Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or Pushkin?
I would definitely say there is something going beyond political oppression. I mean, Solzhenitsyn famously said that the writer in Russia is a second government. So there were always writers in the government and writers who were second and official government. There is a particular role that literature occupied in Russia, as well as in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, and possibly in the Caucasus as well. And I understand what Anne is saying when she's saying how difficult it is sometimes to understand cultural references, because I'm teaching to my students and I'm trying to teach this cross-cultural communication. I believe that one shouldn't be afraid of foreignness. In a way, it's interesting that so many books are translated from English into foreign languages and so few books are translated into English, comparatively speaking. So I think there should be much more openness to foreignness, to the discoveries, to the mysteries of the other culture.
There was an attempt, wasn't there, Gary, at one point to bring Vladimir Sorokin to the United States? Didn't the University of Pittsburgh make an application to have him come to the U.S.?
Yes. And, of course, he was denied. This is one of the most preeminent writers in Russia, but he was denied permission, denied a visa by the U.S.
When was this?
Embassy.
How long
this
ago?
This is, I think, a year or two ago. This is in reference to his movie, Moscow,
mm-hmm.
Which he wrote the script. And Sorokin obviously is not very happy about this. And he gave me this hilarious, he does a hilarious impression of an American consular at the consulate trying to speak in Russian, but it sounds almost as the way some Americans speak English.
Russian speak English.
There you go. So the consular official, he goes into the consulate, and the consular official says, "Are you a writer?" And Sorokin says, "Yes." And the consular official says, "And what did you bring me?" in this kind of tone. And Sorokin says, "What do you mean? Vodka or cognac?"
And the official says, no, I mean, where are your books? And Sorokin says, well, they're in the bookstore. And the consular official stops for a second and says, you have two daughters? And Sorokin said, yes. And the consular official said, they live with you? And Sorokin says, yes. And the consular official says, the American embassy hereby denies you a visa.
And no explanation beyond that.
No explanation. But, it's a hilarious form of censorship in its own right, I think. I mean, I don't think they're doing it because of his work. Obviously, they have no idea what his work is. But it's very interesting that there is a kind of censorship going on here, too, that America is in its own way is imposing.
Censorship based on the hometown of the writer, the country that they would be applying from?
Right. Well, it's a censorship based on, I mean, it's probably done these days for security concerns over anything, not to single out Sorokin in general, but also for economic reasons. But it's a kind of censorship in the sense that by not allowing preeminent writers or by not knowing who the preeminent writers are and allowing them to come, they're imposing a kind of embargo on ideas. I mean, it could have been Sorokin from Russia, but it could have been even more likely a Pakistani poet.
What about Rohinton Mystery, the Canadian-based writer who canceled his U.S. book tour because every time he came across the border, he basically had to take his shirt off to show that he wasn't carrying something with him.
Exactly.
One could argue that perhaps there is, of course, less political censorship in America than, say, in China. However, there are various forms of social censorship.
Give me an example of what you mean, Svetlana.
For instance, I read recently about the censorship of artistic texts at the qualifying exams, I think in high school. I'm not sure which exactly exam it was, that they tried not to offend anybody. That kind of social pressure, sort of tyranny
political
of majority.
Correctness.
Political. I don't know if it's always political correctness. It could be, kind of a religious concern as well. It comes both from the left and from the right. But that kind of propriety, we don't want to offend anybody. We want everything to be decent and bland, that kind of cultural blandness. I think that's the danger in current American context as well.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Ilya is joining us. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Been a great listener to NPR way back 15, 20 years ago on American Armed Forces Radio and Television before they went satellite. I'll be brief. You touched upon censorship, which has an interesting history here in America. If you look, if you recall writers like Henry Miller on Tropic of Cancer, mm-hmm. and William Burroughs with Naked Lunch, and Mailer and Ginsberg appearing on behalf of William Burroughs. Common sense tells us that while experimentation is very important and should be encouraged, there still has to be a line, and the key word here is marginal. A lot of what's going on in popular literature in Russia today will remain marginal 50 years from today, and I do believe that 90% of Sorokin is going to stay marginal. With the great tradition that Russian literature has, while this experimentation has to be encouraged, there has to be an understanding that, simply spoken, there's just good literature and bad literature.
Who decides that, Ilya?
Excuse me?
Who decides what's good literature and what's bad literature? Is that a popular choice?
The readership. Gogol will always be good literature, and Bunin will always be great literature, and Nabokov will always be great literature, and Nabokov,
he was banned in Boston.
Is it too early, then, do you think, Ilya, to make a decision about where someone like Sorokin fits?
Oh, absolutely. You have a very valid point. Definitely. We need for the dust to settle down. We need to look at it 20, 25 years from today and see whether it'll occupy its rightful place in the, in the constellation of great Russian writers. I don't know. To be honest with you, I have strong doubts.
Gary Steingart, how is Vladimir seen in Russia now? Are people rushing to make a decision? Ah, we finally got the start of a new movement of literature?
Nah, I don't think that. I think in some ways, I think Svetlana would say that Sorokin belongs more to the 80s in a sense. A lot of this stuff, this almost scatological approach and this kind of postmodernism has been done, although it was initiated by Sorokin himself. So I don't think Sorokin is starting anything new. In fact, a lot of the young people I talked to, almost there was a kind of backlash against this kind of I mean, there's always in any writing community when something succeeds, I think to a certain point there
everybody
will always,
wants to trample on.
Everybody wants to trample. There will always
Don't
be
worry,
a wonderful backlash. I'm next, right? Yeah. So, but I think Ilya is right. It's much too early to tell if Sorokin is going to be invited into any kind of a pantheon of Russian literature. But again, you know, we Gogol right now is considered a great writer. Who knows what the next 300 years can bring? What kind of regime change? You know, the Russian literature is so closely tied to its political spectrum that one thing I think will remain certain, which Sorokin kept telling me, is that Russian literature will always remain in some ways an important barometer of the political situation in Russia.
Is there an eagerness, do you think, Svetlana, for Russia to identify what its next literary movement will be? I mean, it's been now more than 10 years since the Soviet Union disappeared, since that moment of Soviet literature was, how did he describe it, faded and then withered. I'm curious to know is whether or not there is a bit of desperation to say, what are we? How do we define ourselves through our writing?
I just hope the we in the sentence that you're using is the we of the writers and not the we of the government.
And say within the intellectual community in Russia, are people saying, ah, yes, it will be this person or these three writers, or are people willing to just sit back and be patient and wait and see what comes
their
way?
There was a moment in the mid-90s where people were looking for new ideology. In a way, now there is a new state ideology, and people, I mean, intellectuals, are actually welcoming the diversity. Mm-hmm. I wish there were many different trends and many Russian literatures. That's my wish. I hope it would not be one single centralized Russian literature, because then we end up not with Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, but with socialist realism. I hope that wouldn't happen.
It's true. I mean, what's the past 10 years have been kind of sad in many ways for the Soviet Union. There's been an incredible impoverishment socially, economically, in almost every sphere. And it is sad to see that very few Russian writers, Pelevin comes to mind, but even he, that very few writers have really kind of are on the world stage in a way. I think the way that Indian writers, for instance, have walked across the world stage in the past 10 years. And, you know, Sorokin said that during times of great upheaval, during the perestroikas, the revolutions, Russian literature goes into a kind of hiatus. And only when things do settle down, he thinks, this is his theory, and I'm simply quoting him, only when things settle down, and he does think that things were settling down, is there a revival of good Russian literature? So let's hope that's the case.
Thanks so much for coming in, Gary.
Thank you.
Gary Steingart, author of A Piece on Contemporary Russian Culture, soon to be published in The New Yorker. His new book published this year is called The Russian Debutante Handbook, and in fact, for people in the Boston area, Gary will be reading from that novel tonight at 7:30 at the Leventhal Sidman Jewish Community Center in Newton. Svetlana Boyemol, it's a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
Svetlana is professor of literature at Harvard University. And Connection listeners, if you want to find out more about our series, New Writers and New Realities, you know where we are. Our website is theconnection.org. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.